Hi, and welcome to Preventing Apprentice Dropout, Let's Take Action. This is a joint FE News and Cognosys live stream, and I'm Gavin O'Mara. I'm the CEO and founder of FE News, and I'm joined by three friends, three amazing panel guests. I'll go around to let everyone be able to introduce themselves, but first off is Sally Dickets, who is the AOC President and CEO of Activate Group. How are you, Sally?
I'm really good, thank you, and delighted to be here, Gavin, talking about what's a really important topic.
It's an incredibly important topic, and just to put that into context, the reason why we're saying let's take action is 35% of apprentices drop out or are non-completers. I mean, that's a huge, huge stat, as we can see on our ticker at the bottom, and that's a huge number. So, and what we want to do today is, the time that we've got is to try and come up with some sharing some ideas, sharing some solutions, because this has got to, it's got to reverse this, basically. My next guest, and if you've been a long-term viewer of FE News, my previous co-host for the Exploring Neurodiversity podcast is Dr. Louise Kowalski, who is the Director of Education for Cognosys. How are you, Louise?
I'm very well, thank you, Gavin. I'm pleased to be back here with you for more invigorating conversation.
Yeah, it's so important, though. It's just this sort of next stage of how we can sort of make impactful change, really, isn't it? And there's been a few amendments and changes recently, which is a bit of the elephant in the background of the room, if you know what I mean, which we're going to talk about in a bit as well. And many of you may not know Helen, but I'm really pleased you're with us, Helen. Helen Wilson has just put together a really cool handbook, which is just literally exploring all of this topic. And this seems a really, really good person to bring in. And the handbook is all around how do we address the dropout rates with apprentices. So Helen, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me. And yeah, everything I do with when I'm writing handbooks is all about trying to give really practical advice, because there's a lot of kind of thought leadership in the sector, but kind of not a lot of sharing of ideas. And I think there's space for that. And I just really, you know, hope that it provide some helpful, useful advice that people can kind of just take away and run with.
Yeah, definitely. And everyone's going to get to know Helen much more, and I'm sure we're going to see much, much more of you, because this handbook is, I was really, really impressed. Some stats I'm going to completely rip out of that in a little bit, which is just really interesting, and many I didn't come across, you know, and I just think it's really, really interesting to sort of move forward. But kicking this all off, I'd like to start with you, Sally. You know, everyone knows that learner dropout is a really serious issue. How much energy has gone into, you know, raising the profile of apprenticeships and social mobility, everything about it is just really, really good. 35%, depends how you cut stats, all stats are cuttable, but say 35% of people, of apprentices at the moment are dropping out, which is a huge number. We've gone through a bit of change recently. The last 18 months has been a little bit unusual. How has recent events impacted apprentice completion rate or dropouts, would you say?
Oh, I think hugely. If you're a hairdresser or a chef, you were virtually out straight away because so many places were closed. And I think it's interesting, they were furloughed to begin with and then they just lost their jobs. And of course, now we're seeing a huge impact on restaurants where they're closing because they just can't get chefs. And so in a way, it was a short term, let's put everybody on a furlough, and now they're suffering. So I think there is a big issue. If we take our biggest Activate, our engineering, caring and health and leadership, and for different reasons, they've all been hit. Engineering probably the least, because they've maintained their jobs. Leadership's been hit because we deal with first line managers, many of whom have furloughed their team and so are partly doing their job and just could not give the 20% off the job training. So they had to stop and are now beginning to come back. And the same for care, because of all the issues with care homes. And so I think the pandemic has had a huge, huge impact. But I think there are things, and I'll leave that to the later questions, that we could do better. I think the pandemic has really hit apprentices very badly. To try and get an endpoint assessment for some areas has been virtually impossible, because to be fair to the centres, they were closed. So I think it's been a perfect storm to create what we've seen here. But I don't think it... means that apprenticeships aren't still really, really worth doing. I just think we have to overcome the glitch and move forward.
Yeah, think, yeah, very, very much.
On that, Sally, as well, like, we have to acknowledge how much support the sector has given to learners during this time, you know, in such great adversity, really, and such, you know, times of uncertainty. The sector has really pulled together and gone above and beyond to support these learners and keep them safe and keep them educated as best they can. But still, yeah, it's there's a huge problem, isn't there? And no doubt will contribute to dropout rates increasing.
And the real shame is those particularly engineering practical students who were just about to get their endpoint assessment and were ready and then literally had to defer it in some cases to 6 months. And you're right, we've done a lot of online stuff. But if you're, a plumber, they've had to come back and regain skills, which has been tough.
Yeah,
very much. Helen, how about you when you put in the handbook together? Did you come across any interesting stories from different people or sort of adversities they've overcome or seen?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting. I was looking, and to my knowledge, I think the Department for Education are not releasing any provider-led statistics for the last year, and we don't need to see those to know that it's not good. And what that kind of says is that everything we do now has to be around improving outcomes, driving these positive changes. And in terms of the handbook, I kind of delved into a lot of the research that Department for Education, as well as the national achievement rates tables, and the dropout rate has been a consistent problem, that we just, it's about keeping on going and driving it. And I think the main thing is that I found that was quite interesting is that learners with learning difficulties and disabilities who will have been disproportionately affected by the pandemic are more likely to drop out of their apprenticeship. And so there needs to be a real focus on learners with different needs, adapting to different needs, and continuing to do what everyone knows that we have to do in the sector, and that's reduce the disadvantage gap.
Yeah, very, very much. Sally, I mean, you've highly experienced and worked in the sector for a really long time. I won't ask the number of years, but like, you've lived it, you know, and you've been through it. Has apprentice dropout rates or non-completion, depends how you word it, do you know what I mean? Like, has this always been sort of, you know, a part of the system? And, you know, if so, what is a sort of number we need to be aiming for? Because not everyone's going to complete. There's going to be situations and circumstances. But, you know, is this sort of an age-old problem that has just sort of been sitting in the corner and no one's really wanted to shine the light on? Or what do you sort of see from your experience and background as sort of the way forward with this?
I mean, you're right. There's always been dropout. I think anybody that says, I've taken on 1,000 apprentices and they all complete and do live happily ever after is amazing, and certainly we're not one of those. I think Helen is also correct. The more disadvantaged you are in terms of having specific learning difficulties, particularly in apprenticeships, I think employers aren't always very familiar or understanding of learning difficulties. They misunderstand it and think, oh, are they somebody with severe learning difficulties? No, they can have a whole range. And I think it's about how we've educated our employers, which isn't brilliant. I think the relationship you have with the employer is really, really important. I think the support that we give students with learning difficulties and disabilities in the apprenticeships certainly is not always as good as we give to study programme students. And I can bore for Britain on the reasons for it. I think, actually, to be fair to Cognosist, the burden of the administration, which is immense, particularly for apprenticeships, they have hugely lightened. But I do think the education and training of assessors and people who engage at the work end do not have necessarily the training or understanding that we've perhaps invested in our study programme staff. And that's certainly something we're aware of and trying to address. And that causes dropout. And I actually think there should be an element of dropout if we're going to have high standards. And I think some young people make the wrong decision and we should be much more flexible. If I start hairdressing and I hate it, I think you should be able to move into other things much more freely. And I think the flexibility of movement creates more dropouts than we need.
Yeah, no, definitely. And there's whole new schemes coming on board with the flexi job apprenticeships and stuff like that, isn't it? To looking more at careers, isn't it? Because the world of work has changed. But I think it's quite interesting that they've gone down that route and recognised that, to be honest.
Yeah.
Louise, Sally mentioned a really interesting point there around how we develop and around CPD needs, really, for staff around how to be able to support learners. Because, and jumping into Helen, in your handbook, you had some interesting reference points from DfE. It might be a good idea to share those before I then ask Louise something, actually, around DfE recognised that there was, obviously, they did a study 2019, I think it was, around what was the what was the reason for apprentices dropping out. Did you want to share some of their findings from that? Because I think that's interesting. That's from DfE, do you know what I mean? They're recognising this, you know.
Yeah, it was quite enlightening when I was researching this. And one of the main points that came out, that there's a lot of reasons why people drop out, but for a significant number, they were driven out by a poor quality provision. And I think now, for me and a lot of people in the industry, quality is synonymous with equality. If you're not providing a quality provision for all apprentices, then you can't be saying that you're providing a quality provision. And another one that was learners who dropped out often questioned the support they received and how responsive tutors were. And this isn't necessarily an individual thing, it's a process thing, you know, it's a company-wide thing. It can't just solely, all of the responsibility has to lie on tutors. It is creating a whole culture in your organization that starts at the top and enables everyone to kind of have, you know, confidence themselves, like staff to have confidence to, as Sally was mentioning, like to address these needs and to kind of build a really, really joined up approach that also involves the employers and the EPAOs. Like, it is everyone in this all together.
Yeah, definitely. Louise, that literally segues totally into you. Like, so you guys have got, Cognosys have got a huge, huge, huge data set of what's happened with different learners you've worked with, but also with different providers that you've worked with, both college and independent training providers. What could you share some of those sort of stats? And also the whole CPD suite. So like what Helen is saying around, what DfE have found is it's down to quality of provision, but also some learners feeling not very well supported. That this both those sort of smack of a CPD need, don't they? You know, like how can we support people better with this, you know?
Yeah, completely. I mean, I've heard firsthand anecdotal evidence from tutors saying prior to having training with Cognosys, they used to dread having a learner come to them with a diagnosed need because they were so afraid of providing the wrong type of support or the wrong type of communication for that learner. So what they did was actually ignore the need because that felt like the better thing to do, the right thing to do, and just let the learner struggle on. There's a huge requirement for, and it's not masses of training that's required. It's, you know, accessing handbooks like the ones Helen has produced, like just to look at practically, how can I deliver a tailored program? How can I communicate in a tailored way with my learner? The main thing for me is case by case. So our stats, you know, we've assessed well over 100,000 learners now over the last 4 years. And our data is showing us that one in three apprentices actually has a neurodiversity, which could pose a barrier to their learning or completion of their apprenticeship program if it goes unsupported. So, you know, just familiarity with that sort of number and what that means in terms of learners. You know, this isn't a sort of abstract figure. This is prevalent in every single training provider that we worked with. So just that knowledge and confidence to say, okay, I need to do something differently for this person. There's plenty of material out there. There's plenty of resources out there. We released a free masterclass that focused just on this to help give the sector confidence in approaching neurodiversity and having that conversation with learners.
Yeah, and it's and to highlight, because I know we talked about this on the Exploring Neurodiversity podcast. Guys, you listen to that if you haven't done already. We covered this a lot around that one in three is actually people that it was hidden. They didn't know. They probably had a suspicion, but they didn't know that they had needed additional support, which leads me to another point in a minute. It's just 35%, one in three. We're not saying that's that's the solution. Is there's many people's lives are complex, aren't they? There's many different things in there which are going to be a part of that. But surely that's got to help if you're supporting people to support the learner. It's got to help to be able to. Communication seems to be key here, doesn't it? Sally. The next question was going to be where does responsibility lie for dropout? You're a leader. Where does that sort of sit with the apprentice, the tutor, the leader, the employer? And also you've got the awarding organisation right at the very end. There's a whole relationship and there's many parts to it. It's communication is got to be key here, isn't it? Where have you seen good best practice and where does responsibility sit for this, really? It's not pointing fingers, we're just trying to come up with solutions,
I think where I've seen best practice, if I look again in the organisation I have responsibility for, I would say that it's how have you built the relationship with the employer? Because I think it's fine to say, and I do agree with Louise, if you haven't trained your tutors, if they don't know what to do with somebody who's severely dyslexic, which I'll take as I understand that, and all you do is try and put that, bury it, then that creates a huge issue and the dyslexic student will fall further and further behind. Another thing that we're finding increasingly, particularly as you move level two to level three, often with boys, is that their level of reading to survive on a level three program needs to be 15 or above. A lot of young people don't as such have a neurodiversity issue, but what they do have an issue with is they can't read properly, but they read sufficiently to survive in the work they're doing. But not sufficiently, they're too slow, therefore, at actually doing the work at level three, and they drop out because they feel humiliated. They don't want to tell their employer they're not reading well enough. And therefore, if you build a really good relationship with the employer, and now the tutor not only has, or the student not only has the tutor from college, but the business manager in their work, and all of them are working together and appreciate and support whatever that issue is, whether it's reading, whether it's dyslexia, dyspraxia, that creates far less of a dropout. And if the senior leaders at both the college and the employer measure the dropout, particularly as Helen said, of students with diverse needs, then the dropout drops hugely. Where none of that's in place, frankly, it's a lottery. If you happen to have a good tutor on a good day, you stay. If you happen not to, you fall out. But if the business is actually monitoring what happens with the apprentice, the college monitors what happens with the apprentice, then it's less of a lottery.
Yeah, no, that's really, really helpful. So, Helen, I don't want to keep referring and then ask you to give us loads of stats because I'm like sort of pushing Captain Stat on you there a bit. But just because neurodiversity isn't just dyslexia, we know it's much wider than that. But just because Sally picked up on that, I think the British Dyslexia Association had a really interesting stat what they found that was in your handbook. Actually, I don't know if you wanted to share that because it just sort of highlights something which again is communication. Again is raising awareness, again, it's like a CPD need, basically. It's just sort of, there's a couple of things coming out here, really, now we're talking about this. It's just, I didn't know if you wanted to share that at all.
Yeah, so it's the British Dyslexia Association, 80% of young people leave school without a diagnosis of dyslexia. So that's 80% of people with dyslexia do not receive a diagnosis. And equally, there was a recent study by Cambridge University that found that autism is much more common than previously thought. And I mean, it shows that there is kind of, there's that lack of identification there. And also within the education system, the reliance on formal diagnosis means that a lot of learners never have their needs identified. You know, as Sally was saying, it's only the severe cases that kind of tend to get picked up at school, the really noticeable, you know, and we are getting better at identifying learners who require support. And I think that's, you know, in schools and in apprenticeships as well. But yeah, it's just kind of having more access to identification, more access to support, I think it's just really important. And it highlights that there is a significant number of learners who are not receiving the support they should.
Yeah, no, definitely. Louise, in your sort of experience, because you deal with, you know, hundreds of providers, like, and then, yeah, people that are, you know, educators and leaders, how often, I know we've had this conversation, you know, off camera many times before, actually, but around how neurodiversity can be quite hidden. You know, we've seen it with the one in three before people start an apprenticeship. But how often is that a sort of a forethought, or is it a bit more of an afterthought around people around, well, why could there this be this challenge? Why is this barrier in place? You know, how often are you sort of seeing that sort of changing of recent?
It's changing, but it's changing slower than I would like. So yeah, many recent conversations I've been in about diversity, disability seems to be just a sort of add-on to the conversation still, and neurodiversity even more so. It can't be an add-on. This is part of our thread, our education, our work. And as Helen said, you know, it's neurodiversity is far more common than we expect. And in fact, interestingly, a recent data analysis that we completed is showing that neurotypical is actually less common than neurodiversity. So, you know, we talk about brain profiles and, you know, your cognitive performance. What you're unlikely to see really in our data is someone with a completely flat profile. So actually, we all have neurodiversity to some extent. And that's really important for anybody who works with anybody else to understand. You know, as Sally, you mentioned, you know, you could be having a conversation with a team and everybody interprets that information in a different way. So a tutor stood at the front of a class with 30 pupils looking at them, thinks they're giving the information, which could be, you know, well thought out, salient, comprehensive. Actually, those 30 people are perceiving that information in 30 different ways. So, you know, this can't be an add-on. It can't be an afterthought. This needs to be, cognition needs to be at the forefront of everything that we're doing.
Yes, very much. Yes, Sally.
Louise, earlier you were saying about how Cognosist does a lot of training with staff to prepare them. And one of the things, it's only taken me about 40 years, but I'm a slow learner, is we do things like that, but you do it once. So I've got a whole group of staff. They've been through your training, tick, move on. And what's frightening is you need to do it every year. You don't just do it one year. And we've done that loads of times. So we've got 10 people who are working with our apprentices. They're okay. They've all been trained. We've got 10 new people and we're great. We'll train them. We never go back to the original 10. And unfortunately, if you've got a dyslexic this year, and then next year you've got somebody with autism, for most of us, it's like, oh, I don't know how to deal with it now. So I think the other thing we're learning, and we've been very slow to do, unfortunately, is this training, even though it's the same training, needs to happen literally every year with the same people till they virtually could do the training themselves. And it sounds really obvious. But as I say, we've caught some real colds on, but that person, why aren't they dealing with it? They've been trained. And you talk to them and go, well, yes, but I only got, going back to what I heard this much of the training. The training was that much. And apparently you need training between 8 and 10 times exactly the same to have got it probably, all. And that's as a training establishment. Now what's the employer, poor things, where this isn't their business? How are they dealing with all their neurodiverse apprentices? And certainly, I mean, I would concur, Helen, being dyslexic, and that wasn't discovered till jokingly I did a test when I was at Milton Keynes College in my 40s that I discovered I was dyslexic. I just thought I was a bit stupid and was the worst speller in the world. So that must happen with all types of diversity. That we don't, and there will be things we're not even clear about in some individuals where they'll have so many multiple issues that they will be facing things that we haven't even thought of.
Sally, I'm totally with you on that. And although, you know, I think it's great that you call that out. I've sort of started to find out stuff in my 40s too. And it's an eye opener. And, you know, so that's like half of us at least on these calls, you know. And it's just, you know, I think we're not alone, you know, and I think that's it's just really interesting. Helen, sorry, I'll cut in. I just wanted this to say, you know, Sally, I'm being brave and telling people about, you know, how it's been for you, because there is this barrier still that people just feel like, I don't want to say, you know, and I sort of want to hide that a bit. And I think that's an issue there in its own right, you know. Helen, over to you. Sorry, I'll cut in.
No, that's all right. I mean, the confidence around learning is a big thing, and we know that anxiety is a really common co-occurring condition for people who are neurodiverse, and supporting those learners is just even more important. And like we've done a recent survey of learners, we had over 600 responses that found that learners who match on our assessment are typically less confident in their abilities to complete daily tasks required of them at work. And that's just, you know, we need to create an environment where they feel like they're able to thrive, and whatever that means for them. And it does take a bit of a trial and error approach. But the thing I think about a lot is that there's no learning without cognition. It's so essential to understand how we actually take in information, how people take in information differently, and create a learning environment and a working environment that just acknowledges this inclusivity. And I think it is a process. It is, you know, you almost need an undergraduate degree in psychology to kind of wrap your head around it. But it's, you know, it's all a process. So we all have to, you know, just keep talking about it, keep doing what we're doing. And I know, as Louise says, like, it's not happening quickly enough as I would like either, but it's, you know, we have to acknowledge that everyone is going to take their own pace to learn this information about neurodiversity. So it's just keeping on the conversation, chipping away and promoting and kind of showcasing the people who are really like leading the way.
Yeah, no, definitely. There's something it's been burning in my brain to be able to sort of talk this out. Now, from the onset, A, I'm not a funding expert. B, I'm not a neuroscientist. But I can see things at times which seem to be a little bit obvious. So this one to me is one of those in the obvious category. Everyone probably knows in the sector, outside the sector, they wouldn't know or care really. But there's been some recent ESFA funding rules. So anyone who's outside the sector of further education sector, that's the Education and Skills Funding Agency. And they're going to be updated for August 2021. And one which really stuck out to me, if we get really nerdy and really sort of whatever, is apprenticeship rules 21 and 22. Most people outside or even in the sector probably wouldn't care about that either, to be honest with you. But I noticed some of the things around additional learning support. And what I interpret, I'm not a funding expert and I'm not a neuroscientist, but what I sort of interpreted them to be was there was a little bit of a warning, a shot across the bow sort of thing, really, which doesn't make sense to me around blanket screening of learners. And when we've been saying around British Dyslexia Association, they're saying 80% of people with dyslexia are not diagnosed, you know, in school. So that's like millions of people. And also, if you look at like the data set from 100,000 people, there's one in three people with undiagnosed neurodiversity. I didn't know. Sally didn't know. That makes sense to me. I'm sure there's a reason why they've said this. I'm sure there's, which I probably don't get. Well, what do you think? Like, Sally, I mean, how, I don't know if you've read into it at all, but how can that affect learner outcomes? How can this affect learner dropout? Because surely that's got to affect things, you know?
Well, if I was cynical, and far be it from me to be cynical, you know, why do schools not note dyslexia? Because actually they haven't got the money to do anything with it. So if I've got money for 20% of my students to be supported, then I'll find 20%, because I'll find the worst culprits and I have to ignore everybody else because I can't fund it. If I am a government that wants to reduce funding, then if I don't blanket screen and I say to everybody, just find the worst culprits, what will happen? And I know what I'd have done if I'd known I was dyslexic going for a job. I certainly wouldn't go for it, because how do I know my employer won't sack me because they think I can't read and I can't write? Therefore, I had very good coping strategies. I'd have disguised it and moved on. So, and the second thing is, what a stigma. Oh, hello, Gavin. Do you have any neurodiverse problems? No, let's find out what they are. No, I'm perfectly normal, thank you, whatever normal is. So I think it's a terrible, if you blanketly test everyone, there is no stigma. Everybody does it. And the anxiety Helen was talking about is spot on. And in fact, if you spent your whole life feeling a bit daft because you're different, at last you leave school, you're now in employment. Oh, it's fantastic. The last thing you want to do is stick out like a sore thumb. So I just think we'll save a fortune and have lots of dropouts. So, I mean, I'm not happy about it at all. I think it also lets a lot of employers, a lot of providers off the hook, because we can say, well, we didn't know. At least if everybody's tested, we know what we're not doing. Going forward, I just think it's the unintended consequences will be quite severe, in my view.
So there's some other things which, you know, sort of stand out to me, and I mean I'm not an expert in this, but, you know, Ofsted, what can, you know, we're talking about quality provision, you know, if we're doing, you know, initial understanding what is the initial assessment for a learner, then surely it would help. Also, you know, things like being, you know, Louise mentioned it around the Equalities Act and stuff like that, you know, like, it, you know, some things are hidden, you know, around the ways you should support people. Am I barking up the wrong tree here and got this all completely, you know, back to front, or is this just sort of something that's obvious to a lot of people, but it just sort of seems to be a rule which hopefully doesn't come into place, can actually be sort of amended slightly, or maybe sort of unpacked in a different way that everyone can understand the intention for it. It isn't doing all this crazy damage. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if anyone wants to sort of, am I, you know, what do you think, Louise, around Ofsted and Equalities, if you can't screen someone?
Completely. So just referring to what Helen mentioned earlier in this conversation, you know, to get an assessment through an educational psychologist costs a few hundred pounds, and there's long waiting lists, particularly now in the pandemic situation. Just because an assessment is widely available doesn't make it generic. So blanket screening, like, it sounds derogatory, but actually it's a hugely positive thing. It's inclusive. It puts, if it's part of the enrollment process, everybody does it, as Sally said. In regards to Ofsted, in the EIF, you know, time and time again, it references accurate starting point. So how can you truly understand your learners? How can you truly map an adequate curriculum for all your learners and plan tailored delivery without fully understanding how somebody thinks? So you're not barking up the wrong tree. You're totally spot on, in my opinion, Gavin.
I think it's really telling as well, actually, that it was an article by Paul Joyce, who's the deputy director of FE and Skills at Ofsted, yesterday, in fact, maybe it's Monday, actually, said that it was all around the need to put young learners with SEND at the centre of our recovery plan, could not be clearer. And I just, the thing for me is that some learn, like we all have learning needs, but some of us get our needs met by default. And the, I just think that the indirect discrimination that can happen throughout a program where, you know, if we're not thinking about this, if we're not paying attention to this, we might not catch the difficulties that some learners are having, and therefore they're not, you know, they might drop out, they're not having a good learning experience, quality learning experience, that we really need to be aware of this. And it's not easy for tutors, for whoever has contact with the learner, to identify these needs if there are not proper processes, if it doesn't happen at the beginning, to build confidence rather than it becomes too late in the program to support that learner, and who knows if they achieve or not. It's, yeah, I think it's telling that that was the kind of Ofsted, the voice from Ofsted, and most of us on Monday were kind of just like wrapping our heads around this funding stuff as well. So
I think it's not just achievement though, it's the effect, the impact on that person. So if you know if your needs are met too late, if support isn't put in place quickly enough, if reasonable adjustments, there's not enough time to apply for them, you've not even had time to work with your reasonable adjustments, you're at a huge disadvantage. And if you end up dropping out or failing, how do you then pick yourself up with confidence and move on to the next learning qualification or next bit of employment? It, you know, it has a ripple effect for that person ongoing.
And especially now when the effect of the pandemic is just being felt, and we have so many people with really shaken confidences, and a, you know, growing numbers of people re-entering education who may have had really negative previous experiences at school and need their confidence to be built up, need to have support in place to fully thrive in an environment that previously they didn't have a great time with, they might not be feeling super confident. So that support needs to really be there, really be robust, and ideally from day one.
But I suspect some of this probably, not that I'm a spokesperson of the ESFA, but if you're an employer, particularly if you're one of the large accountancy firms that has thousands of supposed apprentices, you probably get really teed off that they're all going through this, you know, blanket screening. Most of them are graduates. Why are we bothering? I don't think actually, again, the employers understand. You can have a highly functioning, very able individual who has learning difficulties. Yeah. So I think there is a problem about understanding what screening is. And I suspect there's lots of pressure on employers to get rid of this. Of course, Helen, the courses you're talking about, absolutely we must have screening. But my graduates, they don't need it. It's a waste of my time and money. And I think, you know, you've got these competing pressures all the time. And as the biggest growth at the moment in apprenticeships, unfortunately, has been four and above, none of those employers will value screening, because in their eyes, for legitimate reasons, they'll believe they don't need it. Meanwhile, I suspect if I went and criticised, ESFA would rightly say to me, well, you run your organisation, Sally. If you wish to screen and you believe you're doing it in a legitimate way for your learners, go ahead, and we would still screen. The drawback is there will be lots of programs where employers won't screen. And for the reasons I've given, employers don't understand. You can have very high functioning individuals that do need support. Different type of support maybe than a level one or a level two student. And it's, in a way, we as colleges maybe, or training providers, have not educated our employers well enough, which goes back to me. If we'd built really, really good relationships, everybody, including Kaplan, with the big four accountancy firms, they wouldn't be putting this pressure on government to change the system. So I think that, for me, is a big need to educate employers about learning and all the things, Helen, that you've articulated brilliantly.
Louise, I could see you was bursting to be able to say that, you know, you've, with the data set that you guys have got, you know, level four and above, what do you find for the hidden neurodiversity sort of needs that are there?
There is still a significant need. So it's lower in our data set. So higher level learners are 1 in 5 neurodiverse. And it's funny, Sally, you know, when back in the day when I used to go and train, like I used to speak to training providers on a daily basis, and they, I used to hear this all the time. You know, our apprentices couldn't possibly have needs because, you know, they're studying accounting or IT. Like, okay, they have a different type of need usually. It can't be ignored.
Yeah, I think there's a difficulty as well around the language in the education sector. You know, we're talking about support, so we kind of have to touch on difficulties. But people who are neurodiverse, like, often see it as their superpower. And we can also identify learners' strengths as well as areas where they might require support. And that, you know, can show them, okay, we're going to support you in this thing, but there is, you can also rely on these stronger abilities to approach tasks that you find more challenging. And that's not, it's part of the stigma, really. There's not a lot of conversation around the benefits, the strengths, and how this can, you know, really improve teams. It's good for employers, it's good for the individual, it's good for everyone. And it's kind of, it is, you know, slowly catching monkey, changing the language across. I think it's particularly hard in the education sector with a lot of the funding around additional support needs rather than building this. It is part of a core provision, even though it might require extra time, extra work from tutors and a more tailored approach for that learner. It should still be part of a core quality provision. It's not just extra. It's supporting all your learners. It is part of improving quality in the sector, in education, employment, and creating a world, a society where people who are different feel able to thrive, feel valued, and can go on to achieve, progress, live fulfilling lives.
But it's seen as a deficiency, not as, so for instance, if we said to our middle class parents, who are often, their kids are on our, say, creative industry courses, A-level courses, there's all this extra tuition that these kids can have, your child can't, they would absolutely go ballistic. The letters, you know, because it's happened. But we go, here's some special training for our special students. How dare you say my child is special and they're not doing that training? So I do think it's also, how do we absolutely sell it as gifts? And empowering the gifted, opposed to, oh God, we've got all these kids, we'll give them this special need. And in the TES on the 18th of June is a really good article, which I would read, wouldn't I, which is all about dyslexia. And actually Helen sort of saying the stigma of dyslexia, but actually all the benefits of being dyslexic. And of course, I love them and took all of those on board. I've definitely got all those skills. And, you know, we should flip it. We should really, as you were saying, talk about the superpowers and how, you know, if you're an Olympic rower, we give you lots more and make you even better. You know, you've got these superpowers. This training is to make you even more super. It's not remediation. And it's this concept of remediation that somehow, and again, it's our staff, because I can think the way some of our staff sometimes talk about students, you can sort of hear it in their language, which is, well, I'm helping them and it drives me mad. No, learners help themselves. You're providing the wraparound support and environment for them to flourish. You're not their mother.
And how does that build the confidence of the learner if they, exactly. You know, it's the non-verbal cues, it's the language we choose to use. I think it's it is hard, and it is sometimes dictated by legislation and by funding rules, but there's a lot of space for us to do better and to approach. And it's the initial conversation that you have with that learner, the confidence that you as an organization exude when you're talking to them about their needs and going, even if you're not quite sure how you're going to approach it for that particular learner, you can say, you know, we are going to like support you in whatever way you need so that you can kind of do your best. And it is the learner that kind of does the work and can kind of, they can help themselves, as you say, Sally, like, but we can just provide that sounding board and that baseline of kind of, we're here and you can do whatever you need to do and we've got you covered kind of thing.
Now they need a coach or a mentor. I mean, I have two coaches. So why, if I was a 17-year-old, don't we? I mean, we call ours performance coaches to try and get away from, here's a teacher with a student, psychologically for the staff and the students. But that is what we're talking about, is a coaching mentoring relationship, not a God supplicant relationship.
I was going to go on and ask you about the coaching sort of way forward that you, I know we did a podcast on it ages and ages, yeah. And it's before the pandemic, seems like another like lifetime ago, doesn't it? But like changing that chalk and talk to being much more around wraparound and coaching and enabling, you know, and sort of coming alongside rather than, you know, at the front and everyone sort of sitting in silence type of approach. Anyway, how long ago was that? You know, and it's a sort of, do we need to be updating another CPD need again around delivery and sort of leadership, really. But time is just disappearing. It feels like we've not even started to scratch the surface on this. Maybe if I could go around and ask it, because it seems to me that from what I could hear, and trying to be two ears, one mouth about this, because everyone's got an opinion on this, you know, is communication seems to be one of the major things that everyone is saying here is could really help with apprentice dropout and non-completion between the several parts of relationship, really. And some bits I didn't even come into this thinking about, really. So, you know, with the learner, the apprentice themselves, with their educators, so with the people that are working alongside them, whoever that would be in a different part of the journey, the leaders then also leading those educators, the employer and the relationship between the provider, like college or ITP with the employer. We haven't touched on the you know, endpoint and all the rest of it around, because we've just run out of time. And it's just, I think there's just so many more conversations we can have here. If we were to go around, like, Helen, if there's one thing you would want to sort of change, particularly around thinking about apprentice dropout, what would you want it to be?
I think the communication obviously is incredibly important, but I think for me, it's one of the tips I've put into the handbook, is that to align your learner journey to your equality, diversity and inclusion commitments. Like, we all talk about it in the sector, we're all super driven to improving all of these areas, but actually focusing in on every step of that learner's journey, being super clear about what needs to happen to support learners and really provide that supportive environment for every single learner is what's really important. And from a communication standpoint, I mean, it's got to be, you know, starting point, initial conversation with the learner. It doesn't, you know, it shouldn't matter what kind of needs they have. It's just every learner, get a really clear starting point, know what they need and provide the best environment for that learner. And that can mean lots of different things, and it should mean lots of different things. If you don't have lots of different ways to provide and support apprentices, then you are going to struggle to support quite a number of them on program. And yeah, it takes a joined up approach. And I think there's loads, as you say, like, we fairly scratched the surface, and trying to find one point is highly difficult. But I'm going to do a little quick plug. And obviously we've talked about the handbook, but it's free. Just take it, read it, see if there's anything that you can pick out of there, because I've just, I always, always want to give practical advice. I've gone to lots and lots of events where people are talking about equality, diversity, inclusion, and they're saying, you know, how important it is, the impact, and then they've kind of got statistics of how they're doing as an organization, but there's no like, here's what we're doing, here's how we do it. There's kind of not as much practical sharing within the sector, and I think they're, I want to encourage more of that. I know there's loads of people who do want to encourage that, and I think there's lots of space for it. So, and there are obviously lots of other content and ways that people can think about this that aren't and just a, not just in a single handbook. So,
Sally, how about you? What would you want to see as one change? I know it's going to be loads, but if you could just pick one.
If I had a fairy godmother and there's only one thing that could be achieved, it would be, and it's going to be a very long sentence, it would be a very well-enabled staff who build amazing relationships and trust with the employer and the apprentice.
Yeah, that's a cool line. No, I think you should keep going with that. That's fantastic. Yeah, I think building trust and its integrity as well of team, isn't it? And this thinking for the good of the learner and good of the employer, really, isn't it? And sort of looking beyond funding bans. You know, I think sometimes we can get restricted with that. That's a brilliant point. Louise, what would you say is your one thing, if we could, to be able to start to make a difference here?
More rigorous processes to share visibility of outcome data. So I think there's too much focus on number of starts, not enough on what happens after that. So for me, I'd want to know why things are not working out. And you know, apprenticeships attract so many different types of person, different background, different experience, different age, different sectors, different cognitive needs, different disabilities. I'd love to look at that and just really dig deep into true reasons, into how we can improve things. So yeah, visibility of outcomes for me.
But I would like judgments, not one of my worries is the unintended consequence of merely saying, if you don't get 100% completions, you're crap. What you then do is you teach to just make sure you complete. What I would like is some students shouldn't complete, but it goes back to Helen's point on the learner journey. It might be right for you to go on another journey, but all of that should be mapped. And if I make you stay and virtually say, there's 50 quid, Gavin, just get through this endpoint assessment, that to me is also cynical and unacceptable. But to ignore the endpoint, if I want to be a hairdresser, yeah, it really annoys me when somebody says, well, it doesn't matter, she had a good journey. No, if I wanted to be a hairdresser and I didn't get my qualifications and I can't do hairdressing, that's a failure. So this very simple way of measuring us, I'd like it a bit more nuanced. So I agree with you, Louise. If we don't have the data, how do we know anything? But I think it needs to be nuanced so the student journey is genuinely measured rather than just they must X.
Yeah, people are individuals, aren't they? You know, and everyone is going to go for things in a different way. I'm gonna throw my thing in. Why not? If we can, for me, I think if we could Jordan, everything that everyone said really is this blue sky big picture. You know, just to look at like things like this. Yeah, they recommended change. What could the impact be for that? You know, looking at like what you just said around like everyone is an individual. You know, around Helen, what you're saying around EDI, how can we bring everyone together? There's almost, I don't like the term because it's a bit of a weird one because I just think of people jumping in boats and attacking beaches, really, but like a task force around what can we do to sort of to look at this. And I think who should be responsible for that? And I think really it shouldn't be someone who's, you know, a civil servant. They should be a part of it. It shouldn't be someone who represents a college. It should be college, provider, employer, apprentice. It should be support sector around it. And if we could come together as a sector with all of those brains, all of that passion, so we will be able to fix this. And I think for me it would just be great if we could have something like that, you know, is to bring us all together, really, because between us all we have got the ability to change this. And if you change one person's life, that's cool. If you change a, you know, that changes family, that changes, you know, opportunity. If you change it en masse, that's leveling up, isn't it? You know, and we all just want to be able to make a difference to people at the end of the day. And, you know, I think Cognosys has got a really cool term, leaving no learner behind. I think I'm saying that right. And I think, you know, that's something which we should be taking on as a mantra anyway. Why are we doing it otherwise? We want to make a change to people's lives, isn't it? You know, so thank you, everyone. I think, you know, to be honest, this could be a series gone forever, but I think it would have an outcome. I think it would work. And I hope everyone who's been listening in, this is our first ever live stream. And I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got something out of it. And I hope it means, what's the point of these if it doesn't, you know, stir you to want to change, to be able to hear new ideas? Helen, thank you so much. And thanks for putting that handbook together for the good of everyone. You know, Louise, as always, it's been a pleasure to go on this journey with you. You know, it started knowing you a bit before, but in doing that co-hosting of that podcast, I really enjoyed that, you know, honestly. And thank you for joining us. And Sally, honestly, that I could talk to you forever about that coaching model that we talked about at that I think it was an ETF.
Yeah,
and I loved that. And I think the passion that you're bringing to wanting to make a difference to people and to share your journey as well is just really, really key. And yeah, what a lovely live stream we've had to bring of people with all this passion together. And I hope that everyone at home and in their office can get something from this and better take things forward. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, the audience. And we'll see you again soon.
Thank you.